Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein, radio for and about the commercial real estate professional. Our focus is exploring issues facing landlords and tenants, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, lenders, and everyone in the industry. Our style is conversation over coffee with highly experienced commercial real estate professionals. Over 35 years, Howard's legal and commercial real estate practice has centered on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio is presented with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our audience. Access our archive shows, upcoming schedule, and engaging articles at creradio.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for CRE Radio. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Welcome to CRE Radio. Today's topic is commercial real estate bankruptcy and what you need to know. Our featured guest is Richard Golubo, and Richard has been on our show in the past. Our call-in number is 619-393-6492. That's 619-393-6492. Remember, press 1 if you want to ask a question or to talk. You could also reach us on Twitter at CRE Radio, or you can ask questions on our website at www.creradio.com. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about bankruptcy, primarily in a commercial leasing situation. And with us, we have Richard Golubo, who is a a bankruptcy expert. Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Howard. Thank you very much for having me back.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself again, a 30-second elevator speech?
Sure. I am a managing shareholder and one of the founding members of Winthrop Cushoe Professional Corporation. We're a bankruptcy boutique law firm that is based in Newport Beach, California. And March 1st of this year, we celebrated 19 years together as a firm. My firm specializes primarily in representing debtors in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. However, we also represent other parties in a bankruptcy and out of a bankruptcy. We do handle a lot of out-of-court workouts and other insolvency-related matters.
First, why don't you describe what a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is?
So a Chapter 11 is a reorganization, and you'll typically find business entities that seek Chapter 11 protection, but individuals are also eligible to file for Chapter 11. And the reason why an individual will file for a Chapter 11 as opposed to, for example, a Chapter 13, which is generally referred to as a wage earner's plan, is because a Chapter 13 has debt limitations that may be exceeded, and therefore an individual is not eligible to file for a Chapter 13. A Chapter 13 is a very expedited reorganization process and also very inexpensive. But once again, that a Chapter 13 is or eligibility for a Chapter 13 is an individual with certain debt limitations, both unsecured and secured, and not many people would be able to satisfy those requirements. So in that case, an individual would perhaps need to file for a Chapter 11.
What are the debt limitations in a Chapter 13?
They actually change every 3 years, and that's based upon cost of living adjustments that are built into the bankruptcy code. So, for example, when we take a look at the most recent version of the bankruptcy code, the total amount of unsecured debts have to be less than $383,175. not a round number. And the total amount of secured debts must be less than $1,149,525. So to the extent that an individual exceeds those debt limitations, then they're not eligible to file a Chapter 13.
Now let's talk a little bit about a Chapter 11. There, ultimately, in a Chapter 11, the debtor wants to get a plan approved. And I'm going to cut in a bit because, and correct me if I'm wrong, A plan is where you go, okay, here's the deal. This is how I'm going to pay off my debts, and this is what I'm going to be obligated to do. And if a plan is confirmed, then that's an obligation of the debtor being the company that files bankruptcy, assuming that it's a corporation. That's a going forward basis. Now, in how many instances is a plan actually confirmed in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy?
I don't have those statistics readily available, and it does differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Well, it is a low percentage, isn't it, wherever it is?
It is a relatively low percentage. And also, at the same time, while people refer to a Chapter 11 as a reorganization, many times what it is, it's really a liquidation in the context of a Chapter 11 where a debtor still remains in possession and in control of the process.
We need to take a break. Today we're discussing commercial tenant bankruptcy with Richard Golubow here on CRE Radio. We will be right back.
CRE Radio is supported by Prospect Now. Locate building owner principals faster and smarter at prospectnow.com. By The Broker List. Find brokers, deals, services, and vendors free online at thebrokerlist.com. And by Techniques Marketing. Grow your key account revenues at techniquesmarketing.com.
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today.
Commercial brokers spend more time selling and less time organizing with Building Blocks CRE. Built by brokers for brokers, Building Blocks CRE is the dead simple, best business organizer out there. Set up and learn in minutes. Track deals, contacts, listings, and more. Easier than ever before. Right now, save 10% when you visit blockcre.com. Use promo code Howard. Remember, Building Blocks CRE. Easy to learn, easy to use. See for yourself. Log on to blockcre.com.
If you have questions or a point you would like to make during the live show, call in at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue to speak live with Howard and his guests. That's 619 area 393-6492 during the live show. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Oh, she says that so well. Glad to have you back with us today. And I know her. I was there when we recorded that. Let's talk about from the perspective of the tenant. You have the Chapter 11, which is a reorganization. That's kind of more of a big boy reorganization. You have a Chapter 13, which is a smaller boy reorganization. And then you have a Chapter 7. So in the commercial real estate context, what is the difference between the three of them?
Well, in the commercial real estate context, there's a lot of similarity. Simply because of the fact that you have, particular code sections, bankruptcy code sections that are applicable to all three chapter filings, whether a 7, an 11, or a 13. Now, keep in mind that with respect to a Chapter 7, what that means is when you're filing for Chapter 7, you are filing a bankruptcy where you are just looking to straight up liquidate. So what you're doing is you've made a decision that you're going to shut down the business. A trustee gets appointed, and the trustee is typically not going to be operating a business. So therefore, what happens is shortly after a Chapter 7 is filed, there's typically grounds for relief from the automatic stay, and the automatic stay is imposed immediately upon the filing of a bankruptcy where a landlord cannot or the landlord must refrain from seeking enforcement of any of its state law rights and remedies, including eviction.
Let's explain what the automatic stay is, because to us lawyers, it's just second nature. But I, for someone who's not a lawyer, that could be totally Greek to them. The automatic stay is really an order by the bankruptcy court, and it's automatic. That's why it's called an order for automatic stay. But what is the overall effect? What is it, what is that order intended to accomplish?
Well, what it's intended to accomplish is to stop any, well, stop the commencement or the continuation of any actions to collect or assess or recover any claim against a debtor that arose before the bankruptcy petition was filed. So practically speaking, with respect to a landlord, for example, where a debtor files and the debtor is not the landlord, the stay prevents a landlord from commencing eviction actions or continuing an unfinished eviction action or attempting to collect any past due rent.
A creditor, when they receive notice of the filing of the bankruptcy, they're receiving notice that they can't take further action. What if they don't receive notice?
Well, then if they don't receive notice and if they continue on with acts that are in violation of the automatic stay, then typically the debtor or the debtor's counsel will catch wind of that, and they will get actual notice at that point in time that any further actions or any actions that were taken are void, and any further actions will be considered in violation of the automatic injunction that accompanies the automatic stay, and that they subject themselves to punitive damages.
It's contempt of court, isn't it?
It can be contempt of court. It can be, but typically, it because of the fact that contempt is normally, it bespeaks of an outstanding court order that's been issued, it's really, it doesn't come up or it's not really considered a court action as much as it is just simply a violation of the automatic stay.
Let's talk about an instance in which the landlord violated the order for automatic stay and the consequences of that.
You're talking about an instance where the automatic stay had been violated unbeknownst
yes.
to a landlord?
I could tell you of one in which the landlord knew, and the local sheriff knew, too.
And what happened in that instance?
Well, I will tell you, this is in one of the unfortunate circumstances in which I was general counsel for a fairly substantial corporation that was nationwide. And we had filed bankruptcy, and in Jacksonville, the landlord decided that they were going to ignore the order. And I got a call at about 5 o'clock in the morning from one of our locations, from the manager of that location, that the sheriff and the landlord were outside with moving vans, and they were moving furniture and equipment out of our premises into the moving van. And I got on the phone and said, "You guys can't do that." And they said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Southern California." And they said, "Well, we're in Jacksonville and we're doing it. And you have to pay us X amount of dollars in order to stop us." So I had them hold off a couple of hours, and we wire transferred money to the landlord's account, and then we took legal action against them. We took legal action against the sheriff and the landlord, and my recollection is that we obtained, I don't remember if it was a judgment or an order, but basically the bankruptcy court out here at that point in time, they had to come all the ways out to California to defend themselves. And I said, "Well, where are you located?" They said, "Jacksonville." And I said, "Well, I'm here in Southern California and we're suing you."
Wow.
And yeah, whatever it was, I don't recall at the time, but we got judgment. But they knew that an order existed. They had received notification, and they just thought that, you know, they had the power to do whatever they wanted.
Yeah. And That's an interesting, that is interesting that they would be so bold. As you brought up beforehand, I mean, you were asking about contempt, whether or not it is really contempt of court. And it's not. At least I don't view it that way from the standpoint that there's no outstanding order. However, the automatic stay is in effect backed by what I would call the bankruptcy court's contempt powers. And, you know, therefore, to the extent that someone is injured by a willful violation of the stay, then the debtor is entitled to recover actual damages, attorney's fees, and where appropriate, punitive damages. So it is always interesting when we do find on a rare occasion that someone is made aware of there being a pending bankruptcy. They are aware, or they should be aware, that there is an automatic stay in effect, and they could really care less.
Well, why don't we pause briefly for a few words from our beloved sponsors? Why don't you stay with us? And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the differences when a landlord or tenant files bankruptcy. And I'd like to talk about what the tenant's responsibilities with regard to possession is in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
CRE Radio is supported by Monogram Magic. For the best in corporate apparel, visit logostolife.com. Buy Note Marketplace. Buy and sell notes online at notemarketplace.com. And by Building Block CRE. Manage contacts, properties, listings, and more at blockscre.com.
The Institute of Real Estate Management believes good management matters and that well-managed properties pay big dividends. IREM delivers the power of knowledge and recognizes the importance of sharing it. IREM serves real estate professionals who manage all property types. They're dedicated to delivering cutting-edge networking and educational opportunities for every stage of your career. How can IREM help you? To count the ways, log on to IREM Orange County, that's IREMOC.org. Learn more today.
What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business, all on one convenient site. PopUpInsider.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. Click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or email to questions@creradio.com.
And welcome back to CRE Radio. Thanks for being with us today. Let's talk about what the tenant's rights are with regard to possession of the leased premises in a Chapter 7.
In a Chapter 7, a debtor is typically not entitled to continue to occupy the premises unless it is going to be paying rent post-petition. But normally what winds up happening is when there is a bankruptcy filing, Chapter 7 occurs, the debtor many times is already or has already vacated the premises. So therefore, there is no rent that would be due or should be due because of the fact that the Chapter 7 debtor has filed for bankruptcy, has shut down its operation, has vacated the premises. There should be no rent accruing at that point in time, and no rent would be due and payable because of the fact that the debtor is no longer occupying the premises.
Now, because I handle evictions and unlawful detainer, actually, a lot of the experience that I have is that the debtors file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and they're still in the premises, and they're looking for delay, delay, delay. They don't know where it's going to end up, but they're looking to delay. And in some cases, they actually abuse. But one of the problems is that when they file bankruptcy and they're still in possession, they take their sweet time getting out. And, of course, they usually don't pay rent. I know what I do, but what is it that a landlord should do under those circumstances?
the landlord should immediately file a motion requesting relief from the automatic stay so that it could pursue its state law and contractual rights and remedies.
Right, it can't just file an eviction lawsuit in state court?
No. No. So it cannot. Now, of course, there are issues sometimes about whether or not a lease has in fact been terminated pre-petition. Those issues do arise sometimes. And to the extent that it has, then a landlord would be free to move forward with simply either the commencement or continuation of an eviction proceeding. However, because of the fact that the automatic stay can be so powerful and because of the contempt powers that the bankruptcy code, that the bankruptcy court has relative to a willful violation of the automatic stay, most lawyers will confer with their clients and say, we need to go ahead and file a motion seeking relief from the automatic stay, even if we think that the lease was terminated, simply because we want a comfort order.
You're absolutely right. Now, of course, I've dealt with this on many occasions, and this will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. When I say jurisdiction, we're talking about the what circuit, federal circuit court that you're referring to.
California
has a what I referred to as a Yogi Berra statute.
It ain't over till it's over.
And it's a statute in which even if the landlord had received judgment for possession of the premises prior to the time or the date that the debtor files bankruptcy, this statute says that the tenant can go back into state court and ask the court to reinstate the lease. Now, mind you, I've never seen that happen in 38 years. I've probably in two or three occasions have tenants actually attempt to do that in state court, and they have lost each and every instance. But they have used that in bankruptcy to try to argue that the debtor can still remain in possession. The order for automatic stay is still good until the bankruptcy court says that it's not. Correct?
Correct. And sometimes what we've seen debtors do is rely upon what could be considered, for example, anti-forfeiture statutes that may be available under state law, trying to I guess reconstitute what could be referred to as roadkill and try to reinstate a lease. It's typically a very, very heavy burden in order to be able to satisfy those state-specific laws and remedies that are available to tenants where leases were terminated pre-petition.
Yeah. Now that is the real key here, is whether or not the lease had been terminated prior to the filing of the bankruptcy petition. And that's usually the guiding line. And there I've seen it in various jurisdictions where the argument is, well, the lease was actually terminated on the date that the notice to quit was served, or the date that the notice to quit expired, or the date that you actually received judgment ordering that possession and the lease was terminated. I mean, there are all kinds of things to think about. So if anybody's listening to this in a state other than California, Washington, or wherever, this is often a really fine-tuned consideration that that a bankruptcy lawyer should be paying attention to, or an experienced unlawful detainer attorney.
So let's talk about this from a couple of different vantage points.
Sure.
So with respect to the landlord, you want the tenant out. The tenant has been paying rent. You just view the tenant as being a deadbeat, not able to pay the rent. bankruptcy is filed, you find out about this, you believe that the lease has been terminated, probably the best, most prudent course of action is file your motion for relief from the automatic stay. In many jurisdictions, there are forms that are already on the bankruptcy court website, and it's really kind of like check the box and fill in some specific information, and then file your application requesting that the matter be heard on shortened notice, which a lot of times the courts will grant that application, so that instead of having to wait what could be 21 days is the regular notice period in the Central District of California Bankruptcy Court. In other jurisdictions, it may be 28 days or 24 days. So the periods differ. But nonetheless, what you want to do is you want to request that the court schedule a hearing and rule on your motion for relief from stay on an expedited basis. That's what you'd want to do because this way, at that point in time, you will then be asking the court for granting relief from stay, even though you think that the automatic stay is not in effect, you will get a court order, which is what everyone would like to have, whether it is necessary or by way of a comfort order. That's what you want in representing a landlord. Now, taking a look at it from the debtor standpoint, let's assume that you lost out on some sort of unlawful detainer action, but that you still do need to occupy the premises post-petition for at least a brief period of time because, for example, you're transitioning over to a new facility. Well, at that point in time, because I've been presented with that situation on several occasions, we will many times reach out to the landlord and the landlord's counsel and ask for an opportunity to continue to occupy the premises, and rent payments will be made post-petition, but at the same time, we're typically party to a stipulation acknowledging that the lease has been terminated as of a date certain, and sometimes claims get fixed in those stipulations that a landlord may have against a bankruptcy estate. Sometimes they don't; they get left for another day. But at least what you're able to do is try to negotiate for a consensual resolution where the debtor is going to vacate the premises, is going to maybe even leave the premises in broom swept, fairly clean condition, which is something that would also be helpful for the landlord from the standpoint of showing the premises quickly. The landlord will, of course, bargain for an opportunity to show the facility during the period of time while the debtor is still occupying it so that a new tenant can perhaps be in the wings and the property can be leased out quickly. That benefits not only the landlord, but it benefits the debtor from the standpoint of mitigating damages and claims against the bankruptcy estate for non-payment of future rent. Like I said, many times those deals get struck where everyone benefits and then people can part, go on their merry way, but at least there is an interim resolution so that it's not a free fall for the debtor where it needs to vacate the premises and is really not prepared to do so. To the extent that that cannot be consensually negotiated, there have been times that we've just requested that the court allow for us to continue to occupy the premises for a brief period of time, notwithstanding the allegation and perhaps the conclusion that the lease was in fact terminated pre-petition. So judges will sometimes enter orders that give a debtor an opportunity to remain in the premises for a brief period of time simply to close down shop and vacate, but also with the understanding that rent must be paid.
I'm going to ask you to take a breath, and we'll be right back with more from Richard Golubo here on CRE Radio.
CRE Radio is supported by the National Retail Tenants Association. Learn more at retailtenants.org. By the Institute of Real Estate Management, supporting you at every stage of your career. And by Tactics, the magazine for shopping center marketing directors. Visit tacticsmagazine.com.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to ProspectNow.com and enter the promo code Howard. Visit ProspectNow.com. How about now? While you're thinking about it.
Commercial brokers spend more time selling and less time organizing with Building Blocks CRE. Built by brokers for brokers, Building Blocks CRE is the dead simple, best business organizer out there. Set up and learn in minutes. Track deals, contacts, listings, and more. Easier than ever before. Right now, save 10% when you visit blockcre.com. Use promo code Howard. Remember, Building Blocks CRE. Easy to learn, easy to use. See for yourself. Log on to blockcre.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. Click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or send an email to questions@creradio.com.
And we are discussing commercial tenant bankruptcy. Welcome back. And we are with Richard Golubo. Richard, let's talk a little bit about a situation that I've experienced where the tenant files bankruptcy, closes up for business, is not operating in it, but they leave a whole bunch of their furniture, fixtures, equipment, and other improvements in the premises. What is the landlord? Can the landlord just go in there and remove the equipment, or do they have to do something?
Well, the landlord should be, once again, filing a motion for relief from stay and requesting a specific court authority to go ahead and pursue its rights and remedies. And so that's what a landlord should be doing. To the extent that it believes it's entitled to certain furniture, fixtures, and equipment, then it's probably a very, very good idea for the landlord to make that clear in its motion, that that's exactly what it intends to do, so that this way it gets a court order from the bankruptcy court acknowledging exactly the rights and the remedies of that landlord vis-a-vis the debtor. So that is definitely the best and most prudent course of action to take, is get a bankruptcy court order specifying what it is that the landlord can do in pursuing its rights and remedies.
So the first thing really that the landlord has to pay attention to is you know, getting some sort of order that makes it very clear that they can enter the premises. And so if they just get an order for relief from stay allowing them to proceed with an eviction or to enter the premises or to terminate the lease or whatever, they get into the premises and then all of a sudden there's all of this furniture, fixtures, and equipment. Now, the next question is, without a bankruptcy here in California, the landlord will give a notice of right to reclaim abandoned property if it's not claimed by the tenant, if it's worth over, I think it's $700 now, then they have to go, in order to avoid liability for conversion of that furniture, fixtures, and equipment, they then have to go through this whole process, which includes the sale and often the auctioning of the equipment. Not only that, even if there's a whole bunch of money owed to the tenant, the landlord is not actually entitled to receive that money from the sale of the equipment. Now, let's add the bankruptcy layer to that. You're entitled, you can go into the premises, but there's, let's say, $30,000 or $40,000 worth of furniture and refrigerators and other equipment, and you have no other order. What do you do? If you're the landlord,
I want to make sure that I understand the question that you're asking, because to the extent that there are assets left behind then state law typically dictates what happens to those assets that would be abandoned at a lease premises, correct?
That's correct. That's without
okay.
bank. That's without,
that's
the
without
bank.
Bankruptcy.
But, the,
right.
but those furniture, fixtures, and equipment are now assets of the bankruptcy estate.
Correct. And that's the reason why, as I was suggesting earlier, to the extent that those assets are abandoned, then what you would want is, once again, in your request, in your motion, you're asking for the ability to take any and all steps that are allowed by contract and state law for you to satisfy whatever claims you have as the landlord. Included in that request for relief would be a specific request that, to the extent that any assets are abandoned by the debtor, that the landlord would be able to dispose of them under applicable state law. At that point in time, once that relief is so explicit, then you would hope, you would think and hope that the debtor and or an unsecured creditors committee, if one is appointed, or more times than not, the secured creditor that may be in the case, who has a blanket security interest against all the assets of the debtor, including those assets that are sitting in the lease premises, that they would fight that request for relief and at a minimum on top of the debtor to say, hey, debtor, we understand that your lease has been terminated, but that's our collateral. So you better go ahead and get in there and get that out. And to the extent that we need to liquidate that and then pay over money into the bankruptcy estate, or from a secured creditor standpoint, they're just saying, pay us, just pay us. So at that point in time, that's where the negotiations or an objection could be filed by one of those parties, just clarifying what the rights of the landlord are and limiting them so that it's just simply possession of the premises, but not the ability to retain any assets that are stored at the facility.
Now, you're talking about a situation in which you've got competent people on all sides. I generally don't run into that situation. And I know that as a landlord's attorney, I would feel very uncomfortable walking in with and asking the court to give me an order allowing me to take any and all legal action that is necessary to dispose of the assets that are in there without knowing what those assets are. I mean, in many instances, we don't even know yet because we couldn't enter the premises. So I could see the situation where I get this order that says, well, okay, you can go ahead and you can dispose of the assets in accordance with state law. I walk in there and there's $100,000 worth of furniture, fixtures, and equipment. I would feel very uncomfortable selling all of this stuff without the court being aware that there's $100,000 worth of furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And somewhere along the lines, I would think that the bankruptcy court would not be happy with me.
But then again, also what you could always do is, to the extent that you don't feel comfortable with your initial motion for relief from stay, you could always go back into court and then ask for an amended order.
And so I have to go back to my client then and go, guess what? You get to spend more money.
Well,
and
then
my client goes, look, I just want to get in there and get rid of that stuff so I can release it to someone else. Think of the other scenario is where if I go in there and I'm uncomfortable with doing anything, can I just go ahead and move everything to storage?
Yes.
I could, as long as I think I had an order.
Well, but even if you didn't have an order, as far as moving it into storage and preserving the assets, you'd be preserving it for the benefit of the bankruptcy estate. I mean, I would distinguish.
So
those
I now
two
have
issues.
To. So I now have to spend more money. I can hear a landlord. This is a landlord talking. I now have to spend more money because this jerk is not even taking his stuff out.
The alternative is you just go ahead and you submit letters, email correspondence, confirmation from the debtor, and all other constituencies that could perhaps raise the issue, and then just say, this is what we intend to do. But nonetheless, those letters or, you know, requests to confirm actions that you want to take may simply be ignored. And then to the extent that you do sell off those assets, you do realize some sort of economic benefit, then it's at that point in time that people start to claim that you violated the automatic stay and or the actions you took were beyond the scope of the order that was entered in the case. So, I mean, those are the issues that you that we all run into, and there's no easy inexpensive fix unless you have some sort of stipulation that a bankruptcy court will approve, authorizing you to take possession and liquidate those assets. But think about it in terms of if you're a constituency, party in a bankruptcy case, someone other than the landlord, and any money that comes in is going to be available for distribution to you and to others. So that's why it's prudent to just, ask for that relief up front in the motion for relief from stay, the initial motion for relief from stay. And sometimes I mention initial, but it could be the only motion for relief from stay. And that's really what you're suggesting, which is, oh my God, this guy's not paying us. And now Howard, as my lawyer, now I got to pay you in addition to not getting rent. Oh, okay, this is great. And then you go back and then you say, hey, remember that order that I got granting relief from stay? Well, I'm not so sure that we can keep the stuff and sell it, so now I need to go ahead and file yet another motion and spend more money. So I totally understand that. I mean, that's the reason why when we started off with the show, I was discussing why I really try to, I counsel clients on staying out of a bankruptcy to the extent that they can and work things out consensually because it's much more inexpensive. But there are, of course, times that that's just not feasible.
We're going to have a few words from the good people who pay the bills around here. But when we come back, I want to talk about that a bit. And you and I earlier had a conversation where I had said, in some instances, for the landlord, the tenant filing bankruptcy is not all that bad. Something short of just getting paid your rent, anything short of that is not really good. But in the general scheme of things, it might be a good thing. And then I want to talk a little bit some way or another of getting either possession back through negotiation or taking care of the furniture and fixtures through some sort of negotiated process of which I've participated on. So let's hear from those really, really nice people who pay all the bills around here. And when we come back, we will continue.
CRE Radio is supported by Prospect Now. Locate building owner principals faster and smarter at prospectnow.com. By The Broker List. Find brokers, deals, services, and vendors free online at thebrokerlist.com. And by Techniques Marketing. Grow your key account revenues at techniquesmarketing.com.
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's L-O-G-O-S, the number 2, then L-I-F-E.com. Logostolife.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or email to questions@creradio.com.
And welcome back. We are here with Richard Golubo, and we're talking about commercial real estate bankruptcies. Now, I had a situation in which I was representing a landlord for like a Jiffy Lube. I don't know if it was Jiffy Lube or something like Jiffy Lube, where there were these bays that were, you know, underground bays, and there were lifts within there. Tenant files bankruptcy, and they've got all this equipment in there, and I want to get in there. They say, okay, you can take possession. And I'm going, okay, that's great, but what do I do with all this stuff? And at first I was arguing, saying that the lifts that were welded to steel buried in concrete were not easily removable, therefore they weren't trade fixtures. And we went through this whole argument, but ultimately we not only entered into an agreement with the debtor, with the trustee, the bankruptcy trustee who had to participate, and we had to have a file a motion to have the court approve the abandonment of some of these assets and the transfer of some of these assets, and having the debtor actually remove some of that. I mean, is that typical, or was
it,
this could have been 20 years ago.
It is typical. It is typical, and let me explain why, especially with respect to, well, there's really two issues, at least two issues, that come up in that kind of scenario. First of all, what you're trying to deal with is who owns what. So there's competing claims to assets, and as you know, you could have a landlord, you could have a tenant, or you could have a secured creditor that is laying claim to either ownership or a perfected security interest and superior rights to others as to certain assets that may be affixed to real estate. So it makes sense for the parties to negotiate a consensual resolution, and in that particular case, so that everyone can understand what the debtor has alleged or has accepted is or is not property of the bankruptcy estate. So that's very good to negotiate for a resolution with respect to that. But then in addition, to the extent that assets may be property of the bankruptcy estate, and if the debtor does not believe that there is any value or there's consequential value in those assets, then what a debtor will do, or a trustee, is seek a bankruptcy court order authorizing abandonment of assets of a bankruptcy estate. And the only way for a debtor to do so, or for a trustee to do so, is to actually file a motion and obtain a court order authorizing abandonment of the estate's interest, if any, in the assets that the debtor believes are of little, if any, consequential value to the bankruptcy estate.
So now I'm spending more of my client's money. I mean, it's important to note that whatever you do, you have to keep everybody advised, in particular the trustee. If you're in a Chapter 11, probably the creditors committee, and you may have to give other people notice of what's going on. But here I am spending more and more of the landlord's money. How can I say, in some instances, a bankruptcy is a good thing for a landlord?
Well, a bankruptcy could be a good thing when you have a debtor who is not a good tenant for one reason or the other. And typically, it's simply because of the fact that the tenant is not paying rent. But to the extent that you want to have a final resolution with respect to terminating that lease and being able to take back possession of the premises and then release it to someone else, then bankruptcy could be a good thing from that standpoint, because it typically does bring finality to the lease agreement itself and also to the damage claims that may be asserted against the tenant.
Okay, let's
But nonetheless, it is still expensive. It is, and here's the thing that Howard, you were starting to touch on that I just wanted to, you know, to just remind people of when dealing with the Chapter 11. In your typical litigation scenario, you have a plaintiff, one or more, and you have a defendant, one or more. And everyone kind of understands which side of that line they're on. They're suing or they're being sued. And sometimes, of course, those that are getting sued countersue for claims that they may have against the plaintiff. In a Chapter 11, people look at it as a reorganization, but it's really litigation. And a lot of it just happens to be law and motion practice as opposed to there being a trial. Although sometimes within the context of a Chapter 11, matters are scheduled for trial and do in fact go to trial. But in a Chapter 11, you don't necessarily know who your adversary is. It's not so evident all the time. So that's the reason why in the context of an 11, you're thinking as perhaps representing a landlord, it's me against the debtor. But really, you have a creditors committee that you may need to deal with. And then you may also have a secured creditor that you may need to deal with. And they may have competing claims, and they may have the sympathy of the court because of the fact that any actions that they may take may in fact benefit the entirety of the bankruptcy estate. So that's why Chapter 11 becomes more complicated. I mean, think about it from this standpoint. Let's just say that you have a debtor whose lease was terminated under state law. But now you have an unsecured creditors committee who's running into court and trying to claim that there are anti-forfeiture statutes or there's some sort of compelling reason that the bankruptcy court should consider for reinstating the lease. Now, why would a committee or some other constituency try to do something like that? Well, perhaps there's value to the lease because it's an under-market lease, and that lease can be assumed and assigned to someone else, and the bankruptcy estate can yield some sort of benefit from selling off a lease to someone else that wants to step on in and now be a new tenant in those premises. So, you know, I mentioned this only because
the landlord's going to be going, hey, no, I want this lease terminated. I want this tenant out because I'm going to be able to grab another tenant who's going to be paying a lot more rent. Now, over the last 4 years, that might not have been the case, but over the next 4 years, it might very well be the case.
Absolutely. So that's the reason why I just wanted to touch on, you know, the interesting dynamic of a Chapter 11 and how you think that in typical litigation, it's kind of linear as far as who your disputes are with, and they seem to be very well defined. But in a Chapter 11 context, it's not necessarily linear. There's other constituencies that have competing claims, and because they're actively involved in the Chapter 11, now the landlord is dealing with certain creditors that it may not otherwise have been dealing with but for the Chapter 11, for example, a landlord or a creditors committee. So yes, the bottom line is, to the extent that you can negotiate a consensual resolution, not be involved in a Chapter 11 or any other kind of bankruptcy proceeding, and parties can agree on how they're going to part ways and how claims are going to be fixed and paid to the extent that they can be, more times than not, that's more beneficial to do.
All right. Let me stop you right there, because we're starting to run out of time, and I want to get to a couple of other issues. Let's start with tenant files bankruptcy. Let's assume for the moment it's a Chapter 11 or Chapter 13, in which case the tenant and the lease isn't terminated. So the tenant's still in possession of the premises. What are the tenant's obligations with regard to the landlord?
Well, post-petition, the tenant should be paying any and all claims that arise from and under the lease agreement. So, for example, rent, common area maintenance fees, any other fees that are chargeable under the lease that are not considered penalties, any prorated taxes, ad valorem taxes, repair costs, you know, things of that sort. So to the extent that those are obligations that arise from and under the lease agreement, those should be paid in the ordinary course of business.
Now, before we go any further, is there an issue, and you and I had talked about stub rent, which is this is the first time I've heard of that term, but I know of the situation. What if, say, rent is due on the first day of the month and the tenant files bankruptcy on the 15th of the month? It's April 15th. What happens to the rent obligation, assuming that the tenant didn't pay rent in April?
This is a, in certain respects, a raging debate that that spans the country, and depending upon which part of the country you're located in will dictate whether or not the rent that was due on the 1st is considered a pre-petition claim, and that all rent for the remainder of the month is also considered a pre-petition claim, or whether or not there is a proration of the rent as of the petition date, which would mean that from the petition date to, through the end of the month, the debtor would be obligated to pay that prorated rent, what we would call the stub rent, because it's considered an administrative claim against the bankruptcy estate. And like I said, it really does depend upon which jurisdiction you're in, because some use what's referred to as the billing date approach. And with respect to stub rent, just to clarify it, it's the amount due to a landlord for the period of use and occupancy between the petition date and the first post-petition rent payment date. And to the extent that that would be considered an administrative claim that needs to be paid, then that could severely negatively impact the debtor's cash flow and ability to be able to reorganize in the context of a Chapter 11, perhaps without the need for some sort of post-petition financing. So in jurisdictions where you look to the billing date, meaning that if rent is due on the 1st of the month and you file on the 15th, that means that rent for that entire month is not due. It's considered a pre-petition claim and need not be paid in, you know, any prorated part need not be paid as an administrative claim. Well, now you just bought yourself 1 month of free cash flow to use during the bankruptcy.
One of the things that I'd like to talk about, and we're going to have to take another break right now. I have this obligation to my sponsors. But I'd like to talk about what does administrative rent mean and when it has to be paid, because that's a very important thing. It's not like the landlord has got to wait a long time on that. And then I'd also like to talk about pre-petition payment of rent, or the failure to pay pre-petition rents, and how that falls into a strategy that many tenants and I used when I was in-house counsel in the 80s to build up a war chest. So why don't we take a break, and when we come back, we will be talking about those matters.
CRE Radio is supported by Monogram Magic. For the best in corporate apparel, visit logostolife.com. Buy Note Marketplace. Buy and sell notes online at notemarketplace.com. And buy Building Blocks CRE. Manage contacts, properties, listings, and more at blockscre.com.
The Institute of Real Estate Management believes good management matters,
and that well-managed properties pay big dividends. Irem delivers the power of knowledge and recognizes the importance of sharing it. Irem serves real estate professionals who manage all property types. They're dedicated to delivering cutting-edge networking and educational opportunities for every stage of your career. How can Irem help you? To count the ways, log on to Irem Orange County, that's IREMOC.org. Learn more today.
What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business, all on one convenient site. PopUpInsider.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. Click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or email to questions@creradio.com.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. We're talking with Richard Golubow, and where we had last left off was a conversation about administrative rent. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Richard, but administrative rent, when you refer to administrative, the term administrative, that really refers to an expense of administration of the bankruptcy estate. And when you put the two words together, the rent word means that if this is a Chapter 11, that just happens to be an expense that is incurred, that is considered part of the administration of the bankruptcy estate, is it not?
That is correct.
Okay. So that's what we're talking about. Now, that administrative rent, when is it supposed to be paid?
Well, from the landlord's perspective, the landlord's going to want its rent to be paid timely every single month.
We're talking about, for the most part, tenant files bankruptcy. The tenant should start paying its monthly rent ASAP.
Correct. And if it doesn't, then the landlord's counsel must go ahead and file some sort of motion compelling payment of rent or granting relief from the automatic stay. Or granting relief from the automatic stay. It would never want to give up the right to the argument that any unpaid rent is entitled to administrative expense priority and therefore to
right.
be paid 100 cents on the dollar.
And administrative rent is important as it relates to the obligations that accrued prior to the bankruptcy. And why do you want to have as much of your rent to be considered administrative rent versus rent that accrued prior to the bankruptcy?
Because administrative claims are typically paid 100 cents on the dollar, whereas other claims that a landlord may have are typically considered unsecured claims and are paid along with all other unsecured creditors. And as we all know, that typically means that the payment is pennies on the dollar of the outstanding
yeah.
allowed claims.
That's right. So now let's talk about strategy. When I was at Allied Education, we knew that we were heading in for a rough time. So I'd say about 3, 4, maybe even 5 months prior to the filing of the bankruptcy, we stopped paying our rents. And much to my surprise, the landlords, with maybe one exception, and this is out of 90-some-odd leases, the landlords didn't do anything. This also includes the Irvine Company. They just didn't do anything. And we filed bankruptcy. And from my perspective, what we built was a war chest that hopefully would get us through the bankruptcy in the millions of dollars. Is there something wrong with that?
From someone that typically represents debtors in a bankruptcy? No.
But for someone who represents landlord.
Cash is king. I mean, really what you want to do, and that's the reason why strategically this issue of stub rent becomes a big issue And depending upon the jurisdiction that you're in, you may make a strategic decision to file a bankruptcy the fifth day of the month when you know that rent was due on the first. And if no stub rent needs to be paid as an administrative claim, then that entire month's worth of rent is going to be considered part of an unsecured claim that a landlord has. So, and just think about it from the standpoint of when you do have those large retail debtor bankruptcies, they could have a couple of 100-300 stores across the country, and you file in a jurisdiction where the stub rent is dependent upon if it is based upon the billing date approach that courts have taken, then no rent needs to be paid as an administrative claim. You can go ahead and occupy the premises post-petition for the rest of that month and not have to pay any rent as an administrative claim. And that could be tremendous because a lot of times, I mean, you were talking about months of non-payment of rent. That's not, you know. So
from your perspective, let me tell you, many, many, many of my landlords, they have this attitude that with commercial tenants, you don't put pressure on them right away. So they go 2-3 months before they actually start putting pressure on the tenant to collect rent. That is such a bad strategy. That's such bad management, in my opinion, that it's just terrible. It's just terrible. And I've been on both sides of that fence.
Well, and from the debtor standpoint, we like it because of the fact that it gives our clients some breathing room.
Yeah.
From the landlord standpoint, like you said, you know, there could be an understanding that that the landlord does not want to push the tenant over the edge. But at the same time, think about it from this standpoint. It could create an opportunity for the landlord to get the debtor to make certain admissions in an agreement, a forbearance agreement, where the rent is going to be, the rent payment will be renegotiated to allow the debtor some breathing room. But at the same time, there's admissions that there's no claims that the tenant has against the landlord. There could be other issues that may have been brewing, and those issues can kind of be resolved as part of an agreement and as consideration for there to be less rent that's due and payable now, but not necessarily waived. So it does create that opportunity for the landlord and the tenant to sit down and to try to work certain things out. The ostrich approach of just sticking your head in the sand always benefits the debtor. There's zero benefit whatsoever to a landlord to just simply ignore it, cross their fingers, and hope that there's ultimately going to be a payment made. We all know that people respond to demands and to leverage, and a landlord typically has a lot of leverage,
particularly in bankruptcy. The landlord is often in a much better position than other creditors, are they not?
Yes, that is correct.
Let's take our last break before we do the last portion of the show. I want to talk a little bit about assumption and rejection and what all of that means.
CRE Radio is supported by the National Retail Tenants Association. Learn more at retailtenants.org. By the Institute of Real Estate Management, supporting you at every stage of your career. And by Tactics, the magazine for shopping center marketing directors. Visit tacticsmagazine.com.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to ProspectNow.com and enter the promo code Howard. Visit ProspectNow.com. How about now? While you're thinking about it.
Commercial brokers spend more time selling and less time organizing with Building Blocks CRE. Built by brokers for brokers, Building Blocks CRE is the dead simple, best business organizer out there. Set up and learn in minutes. Track deals,
contacts, listings, and more. Easier than ever before. Right now, save 10% when you visit blockcre.com. Use promo code Howard. Remember, Building Blocks CRE. Easy to learn, easy to use. See for yourself. Log on to blockcre.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. Click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or send an email to questions@creradio.com.
Okay, and we are with Richard Golubo talking about commercial real estate bankruptcy. So let's talk about assumption and rejection of a lease. What is assumption and rejection of the lease? And let's try to explain it in a non-legal way.
Okay. So premise is that subject to bankruptcy court approval, a debtor may assume or reject or assume and assign an unexpired lease of the debtor. And what that means is that if you have a valid lease that's in effect, that the debtor would be to the extent that the debtor is assuming the lease, it is assuming the lease and making a decision that it will be bound by all terms and conditions set forth in the lease.
And what is the significance of that going forward? Because sometimes, say, a creditors committee is not really that hot on the idea of the debtor assuming a lease. And often the debtor will put off assuming the lease as long as it can. So what's the effect on the debtor both during and after the bankruptcy that makes it so significant?
Okay, well, when you're assuming a lease, it's primarily because the lease is considered of value to the bankruptcy estate. So by assuming a lease, you're preserving value for the benefit of the bankruptcy estate. That's the underlying premise for doing so. And by the way, the process for doing this is to file a motion with the bankruptcy court requesting a court order that the debtor can assume a lease. The flip side, or I guess the con, for assumption of a lease is that when you do assume a lease, any liability incurred thereafter is an expense of administration. What we were referring to beforehand is an administrative claim. In other words, that claim and all amounts due under the lease must be paid 100 cents on the dollar. So this becomes really important, and this is the reason why unsecured creditors committees will typically, in concert with the debtor, fight off the a request or just fight off the thought of assuming a lease unless it absolutely needs to, because it does not want to create a very, very large administrative claim against the estate, because in the event that the debtor is unable to reorganize, then the estate is going to be saddled with a very, very large administrative claim that may never be paid. And it will dwarf, in many instances, other unpaid administrative claims, therefore diluting the ability for all administrative creditors to be paid what they're owed.
Right. And that administrative claim that arises out of the assumption of the lease is going to have to be paid before the unsecured creditors.
Absolutely. Now,
so
typically,
if I'm an unsecured creditor, I'm going to go, look, before you make that commitment, this is better be a good thing that's going to better ensure that I get paid as an unsecured creditor rather than better ensure that I won't get paid.
Correct. A commercial tenant debtor now only has a 120-day initial rejection period with the possibility of obtaining up to a 90-day extension. So as a result, the absolute maximum that a commercial property lessee may delay its choice to assume or reject an unexpired lease is 210 days. After that 210-day period, rejection occurs automatically unless the lessor, the landlord, provides prior written consent for an extension. So that's what happens with respect to assuming a lease. And now the flip side is rejecting a lease, that to the extent that the debtor seeks rejection, it could do it one of two ways. Number one, just not seek to assume it during the initial 120-day period, and the lease is deemed rejected by operation of law, or it can go ahead and file a motion specifically requesting authority that the lease be deemed rejected as of a date certain. And in that instance, what happens is the lease is considered it's considered breached, not necessarily terminated, but it's considered breached, and therefore there are damage claims that the landlord has against the debtor tenant for any unpaid future rent that is due. It's considered rejection damage claims, and that is added along with any pre-petition rent that may have been owed, plus to the extent that there's any unpaid administrative rent that that is unpaid. So the landlord will typically have a claim in that instance where there's at least three components to their claim: a pre-petition claim for unpaid rent, a post-petition administrative claim that should be paid dollar for dollar, and then a rejection damage claim that is capped, and that also is considered an unsecured claim.
What I'd like to talk about is summarizing what the effect of rejection is. And if I may, if a tenant rejects the lease, then the rents that had been accruing after the filing of the bankruptcy petition until the date of rejection, that's administrative rent, correct?
Correct.
And should be paid 100 cents on the dollar.
Correct.
If the tenant remains in possession after they've rejected the lease, that also is administrative rent, is it not?
Arguably, although there are there will be a dispute as to whether or not that claim should be entitled to administrative claim priority.
Okay. What you want to do if you're the landlord is if the tenant's going to reject the lease, you want to be able to get possession as soon as possible, which in unusual circumstances, maybe usual, I'm not really sure, might include getting that motion for relief from stay so you can kick the tenant out. So you've got – see, what happens is if there's rent accruing prior to the date of the filing of the bankruptcy, that rent is going to be an unsecured claim. Then you've got the rent accruing after the filing of the bankruptcy petition until rejection. Let's assume for the moment the tenant is out of the premises at the time of rejection. Then that becomes an administrative claim and gets paid 100 cents on the dollar, or should be. And then there is, as you were describing, this claim that in the bankruptcy code and bankruptcy lawyers call it damages, this claim that of rents that are really owing on the lease through the end of the term of the lease that the bankruptcy code caps. And that amount becomes an unsecured claim also. So
correct.
So the debtor doesn't just get to terminate the lease and walk away, you know, without any repercussions as a result of the rejection of the lease if there are assets available in the estate to pay any of the unsecured creditors, right?
Correct.
What is the cap?
The cap is typically it's either 15% of the remaining term of the lease, the rent that's due under the lease, not to exceed 3 years or 1 year's worth of rent, whichever is greater.
The landlord would typically be interested in that if they believe that there's going to be value in the estate. And that payment would then be part of the payment that is set forth in the plan. So let's say your 15% up to 3 years is the greater amount. That's $150,000 total. All right. That adds to your pre-petition claim, your unsecured claim. So you just added $150,000 to your unsecured claim, which might then total $200,000 if the lease was rejected and maybe you had $20,000 worth of administrative claim. These numbers are just I'm pulling out of the air, but not atypical. Then the debtor goes ahead, puts together a plan. And the plan provides for the payment of various creditors in the order of their priority, correct?
Correct.
And what is the priority generally?
Typically the priority is you have administrative claims are paid first. You then have priority claims that are paid second, and priority claims are typically claims of employee wage claims and also claims of taxing authorities. Then you would have unsecured creditor claims, and then you have claims of equity. So that's your typical tiered priority scheme.
Can the plan come out and say, you know, we're going to pay the administrative claims, 100% of the administrative claims, and we're going to pay 100% of the secured claims, and we're only going to pay 20% of the unsecured claims? Can you do that in the plan?
Absolutely.
Okay. So that $200,000 that you were just awarded because the tenant rejected your lease is now worth $40,000.
Correct.
If they ever really get to you.
that is correct. Now,
is there a limit on the amount of time that you can pay out on a plan?
No, there's no statutory limit.
In a Chapter 13, there is there not?
That is correct with respect to a 13. In a Chapter 13, the typical time frame is 3 to 5 years.
In a Chapter 11, though, it could be saying, okay, here's the deal. I've got $10 million worth of debt. $2 million of it is administrative claims. Another $3 million is secured claims. And the rest is going to be split among the unsecured creditors. The unsecured creditors might not – and we're going to say we're going to pay that over a 10-year period. And it's possible that the unsecured creditors don't start receiving a payment until 5 years later. Is that possible?
It is possible. We've confirmed plans that are similar to those hypothetical terms.
Oy vey.
So, yeah. I mean, and by the way, there's one variation or one thing I just wanted to mention with respect to like a pressure point as far as rejection damage claims, because what comes up sometimes is, well, what happens if I have to make repairs to the property? And what happens if there's other non-rent obligations that are due? Is that subject to the cap or can I add that on? And once again, it's based upon the jurisdiction that you're in. Some jurisdictions say it's subject to the cap. Other jurisdictions, the Ninth Circuit included, say it's not subject to the cap, which would mean that your unsecured claim would be larger and therefore you would receive more money, a higher distribution. But nonetheless, it's still a percentage of what you're owed. Very different than being paid 100 cents on the dollar as an administrative creditor.
If I were to ask you, what's the most important thing that someone should take away from this discussion, what would that be?
I really think that from a landlord standpoint, that when you have a debtor, or I guess I should say a tenant, that has defaulted, or you think that they will default, Do not shy away from confronting that tenant and sitting down and being constructive about that tenant's ability to pay rent. Because to the extent that there are, as I mentioned earlier, any claims that may have been previously threatened or, you know, stated implicitly by the tenant and that there could be some sort of offset or damages that a tenant could be asserting, it's best to deal with those issues up front, be proactive, and let that debtor know that you are expecting to be paid rent when rent is due, and that cannot be ignored, and that you are an important creditor that must be dealt with and must be paid timely each and every month. So that's, you know, rule number one, get your lawyer on the phone unless, it's best to get the lawyer involved. I know that a lot of times landlords, they don't want to spend the money, but that typically results in the old adage of being penny wise and pound foolish. So engage the lawyer quickly, look to work out something consensually, and at that point in time, really see what kind of claims or issues the tenant may have alleged or may allege in the future, and deal with that as part of an overall agreement where you know both parties can coexist, the tenant can continue to occupy the premises and pay rent, and the landlord could be assured that any claims that were being asserted implicitly or explicitly are now resolved as partial consideration for what's most likely going to be a forbearance agreement, where rent may be paid either for a lower amount or there may be some sort of like delay in rental payments. But be on top of it. I mean, you really need to be proactive. Do not ignore a tenant who is anticipated will not be able to pay rent.
I couldn't agree with you more. My takeaway is act quickly. Don't delay. Don't stick your head in the sand. And I would like to add that, you know what, despite the fact that there are rules, a lot of this is negotiable. A lot of this is negotiable, and we didn't get to talk about, you know, what my whole responsibility was after we filed bankruptcy at Allied, but to a great extent, it was to negotiate rent reductions, and we didn't talk about assumption and assignment, and we'll take care of that afterwards, you know, in our later discussions. So how can our listeners contact you?
They could either contact me by phone or by email. Should I give out I can give out the phone number?
Give the firm phone number.
Okay. The phone number is area code 949-720-4100.
I've got a show coming up in 2 weeks with Alan Buchanan, who is in the process of bringing on a clerk. Alan is a broker at Lee & Associates, and he's in the process of bringing on a clerk and outsourcing and trying to get other people to do some of the things that he either doesn't want to do or just it's not very efficient. So we're going to do a show about how to become more efficient as a real estate broker, and we are inviting our listeners to call in and give us your advice. You know, we're going to help Alan become more efficient. It should be a fun show. Richard, I really like to thank you very much. Again, we did a show with you before, and we got to do very little of your portion of the show. And now we did a show, and there's just so much more to talk about that we really barely touched on it. So I'm going to try this thing where I might write a blog post, you know, and embellish upon certain things that we talked about on the radio today. And we'll talk, maybe even have separate interviews or maybe a video interview using Google Hangouts or something.
A video interview with some sort of PowerPoint presentation may be good. Or, you know, as an ode to one of my favorite late night show hosts, David Letterman, who announced his retirement yesterday, we could do a top 10 or top 15 list of, you know, issues that commercial landlords need to be aware of, you know, when dealing with the bankruptcy.
That's great. I've already decided how Letterman's going to end his last show.
How is that?
He's going to give a top 10 list, and stop it too.
Well, I thought he announced that he's actually going to marry his band leader, Paul Schaefer. That's how he's going to end his show. So,
kiss his head.
But anyway, that may be a very good way to go because of the fact that there are, I don't necessarily want to refer to it as 10 issues. There could be 15 to 20, but the bottom line is that these same issues come up over and over and over again. And depending upon which jurisdiction a bankruptcy is pending in will dictate most likely how a court will proceed. But once again, as you mentioned earlier, you know, that's just the law. Chapter 11 is let's make a deal. And if you can avoid Chapter 11, then you're able to do that because you've made a deal. So this is all about just understanding your rights and your remedies and understanding the various traps and pitfalls when a bankruptcy occurs. So, you know, it's a good idea so that your listeners and your clients are better educated as to the issues because then they can proceed accordingly.
Yeah, that's a good way to close. And to our audience, leave comments and see our show notes on this on the show page at www.creradio. And as always, thanks for listening.
Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Every live and recorded broadcast is accessible on your desktop, tablet or smartphone at creradio.com or in iTunes, just search for CRE Radio. Here's how to reach us with your questions, feedback, and show topics you'd like to hear about. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @CRE Radio, via email to questions@creradio.com, or call in during the live show at 619 area 393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our listeners. Howard and his guests' conversations specifically do not offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, please consult your own attorney. Portions of the show may have been pre-recorded. Unauthorized editing or copying of the show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.